Whether you want to escape the snow or plan it, Arias Medical has you covered. Try a rewarding travel assignment during the holiday season with Arias Medical Group. Call Arias at 1-800-340-2619 or visit ariasmedical.com. That's AREUS medical.com.
This is the PT Pinecast, a podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer, bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pinecast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
All right, the best conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. Our next guest tonight is the director of the VCU Run Lab in the Department of Physical Therapy at Virginia Commonwealth University. He studies and publishes on gait patterns of runners of all ages, shapes, and sizes. His current research projects include enhancing running mechanics as it relates to injury and performance across the lifespan and understanding regularity of human movement in healthy and injured runners. He is also the current vice president of the sports section in the APTA. Welcome on the PT Pinecast, Blaze Williams. Blaze, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. Happy to be here.
First question is always the hardest. What are we drinking tonight?
I am drinking a 22-ounce Coronado Brewing Company Triple Hopped Islander IPA.
Wow, that's a lot of terminology in one drink. I like that. That's a big one, too. You're going the deuce-deuce.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I will see that, and I will raise you the Mint Chocolate Stout from 17 Brewing. This one's going to taste like my favorite ice cream flavor because you got mint chocolate in there, and you mix it with beer. So cheers to you.
Thanks for having me.
And this is a first for me. You are currently, what is your location? As I can, we're interviewing via Skype, so I can see it out the window, but where are you sitting right now?
I am sitting with my back to the Las Vegas Strip.
And what are you doing there?
Fortunately, or unfortunately, depending on who you ask, the sports section of the American Physical Therapy Association has its Team Concepts Conference here every December. As the current vice president of the sports section, as you mentioned, it is obligatory that I attend. But we have three great days of programming. This year is with the International Federation of Sports Physical Therapy is joining us, featuring a number of talks on golf and golf medicine this year. Actually have an opportunity for some of our international colleagues to come and speak at the conference.
So, that's a rough gig, man.
Yeah, but if you ever have a chance, or any of the listeners out there have a chance to come to this conference, it's a great conference. There's only about 300 people that attend, and you have a lot of real individual contact with a lot of really great speakers within the sports section.
You're twisting my arm, man. Fine. I will go to Vegas in early December.
Come to Vegas.
That's awesome. Well, cool. So VCU Run Lab, as we heard in your intro, that's cool. That's cool for someone like me, just because I've been a runner, you know, most of my life. When we were studying gait in PT school, the problem I thought was, for me, people just, they move way too fast, especially as a PT student. There's all these moving parts, and I'm like, can you just slow it down a little bit? So how'd you get into the run analysis background? Where'd you start?
Well, I was a PT first, much like yourself. So when I was in PT school, and I had the opportunity when I was at University of Maryland to work with a lady named Mary Rogers. And Mary Rogers is a great physical therapist, a great physical therapy educator, and a biomechanist. She had a biomechanics lab at University of Maryland, and I took an interest in her lab, and through my interactions with her and her kind of twisting my arm to head out to the American Society of Biomechanics meeting, I kind of started trying to understand a little bit more about how people move. And running was a really easy way to get people to volunteer for your research studies.
Sure.
'Cause much like yourself, runners want to know as much as they can about themselves and how they can get faster or stop getting hurt when they run. So that was kind of how things got started. And I had a great mentor in Dr. Irene Davis. That was my beginnings. And I've had about 15 years of learning and growing and collaborating with great scientists, trying to understand how people run and how they get better.
So you're dealing with runners all the time. I can say it because I'm a runner. Sometimes runners are stupid. So you say runners want to know everything about how to get hurt less or go faster. But do we ever actually listen to what you say? Because a lot of times we want to hear it, and then we're like, yeah, well, I'm going to go out run anyway?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think one of the things that you can learn kind of across the board as a PT is how important it is to understand what it is you're talking to your patients about. And that's very, very true with runners. So first of all, it really helps if you're a runner. You don't have to be a runner, but it really does help with that trust if you're a runner. They're more likely to listen to you if they think you know what you're talking about if you've experienced what they've experienced. But if you're in an environment where you're working with a lot of runners or a lot of soccer players or a lot of dancers, it'll pay dividends in the long run to be able to understand as much as you can about those athletes and what it is that they do. And you don't necessarily have to do it or be involved in it, but it certainly doesn't hurt.
I mean, you speak the lingo, and like you said, you use that big T word, which is big, especially in our field, which is trust. If someone says, all right, this guy, he's talking the talk, he obviously knows what I'm talking about, you know, when you're speaking the lingo, I'm sure that does help. So clinical running analysis, that's what you guys specialize in at the VCU Run Lab. Just tell everybody a little bit about that place and what makes it so cool.
Well, I think we're unique in a lot of ways. One of the things that's really cool about it is, again, as a clinician, I feel like a lot of the questions that we ask from a research perspective come from that place. They come from the patients really proposing these questions to us, either in how they present or the questions that they ask us. So we have the opportunity to see patients in a full three-dimensional biomechanical lab. I have patients referred to me by physicians for 3D biomechanical analyses. We spend about an hour with them. In that hour, we're able to talk to them, find out how many pairs of shoes they've gone through in the past 2 years, what's their favorite shoe, what surfaces do they run on, just the real specific information that we need to get from runners. Then we'll go through a static evaluation that's fairly tailored to the running or at least the lower extremity injured athlete. After that, we spend about 5 minutes putting retroreflective markers on them, put them up on our Cadillac treadmill surrounded by three-dimensional cameras, get them running, get them comfortable. Sometimes they'll run for a few minutes, sometimes they'll run for longer depending on the situation. We collect some 3D data. By the time they get off the treadmill and get the markers off and change out of their shoes, we have a full three-dimensional report that we customized over about the past 5 years. That report is pretty much in layman's terms. That allows us to take that report and send it a lot of different places. So I can give it to you as the runner and you get it. I can give it to the doc and it's not too much fluff and graphs and things like that that are going to confuse or more than confuse, irritate the physician. They want to look at something and get some information quickly. It can go to another physical therapist. It can go to a coach. It can go to a parent. It's pretty much set up like a blood test right down the center. If all the numbers, the variables that we've chosen to be important fall down the center of that report, you're good to go. If it's to the right, it's too high, and there's information that we provide about that. If it's to the left, it's too low, and there's information we provide about that. The therapist or myself will then take that information and synthesize it based on our knowledge and our experience, and basically take all those variables and kind of put it together into a real condensed treatment plan. So the last 15 minutes of that hour long is spent usually going over either doing some manual techniques, going over some home exercises, or talking to the patient about what the plan is as far as going forward for treatment or return to run.
That's cool. That's real cool. I mean, I get into it because I'm a dude and I'm a runner and I'm a PT, so I'm into all those like 3D cameras and you're putting the markers on there, and it's like you're talking about that report that comes out. Sounds pretty detailed, but what are some of the things you guys are looking at, or I should say, what are some of the things that usually pop up in terms of not being down the middle?
Almost all the variables that we have chosen off of to be on that report are based off the evidence. So we've chosen kinematic variables that are predictors of kinetics, some of the work that Brian Heiderscheidt and his lab has done. So you look at stride characteristics, for instance. You can look at what we call strike position, which is how far in front of the center mass the foot lands. Think of it as a surrogate for stride length. That's one that oftentimes comes up. Another one that comes up is knee angle at initial contact. If the knee in the sagittal plane is too straight, then they're not going to be a person's probably going to land too stiff, and then they're going to have not do a very good job of attenuating shock up the chain. That's another one. Hip drop, I'm sure anybody who's studied anything about running in the past 5 years has seen something about hip adduction or pelvic drop or knee valgus. All of those things come up more often in our female population than they do in our male population. And then we look at something called femur to foot angle, which is a transverse plane measurement. It's how much the femur is turned in relative to the foot being turned out, which places abnormal stresses and torsion at the knee. Getting that foot and femur aligned in the transverse plane is another variable that a lot of runners seem to have a difficult time with.
Now, things are going to be variable from runner to runner, but who are you getting in to do these analyses? Is it weekend warriors? Are you seeing higher-end athletes? Or what's your general population at the VCU Run Lab?
It is a total spectrum.
Cool.
On any given day, so we have seen kids as young as 8 years old. We've seen people in their 80s. We see a lot of high school athletes. We see our intercollegiate athletes, both at VCU and some of our other surrounding colleges. We had an international Olympic hurdler come in. We've had NFL players, NBA players. But the people that we feel like we help the most and the people that we see most often are those, as you say, weekend warriors. People who are out there just trying to better themselves for whatever that reason is. It could be that they made a promise to their kids that they were going to stay healthy and they were going to lose weight, just be more healthy. It could be that running for a family member who has cancer. They could be they've decided that they want to beat their brother-in-law in a half marathon next year.
Right.
But it's the average person who's out there banging out 10 or 12 minute miles, and they just want to be the best person that they can. And you get so much satisfaction out of helping those people because they're so thankful for the information that you provide. We see some of the human interest stories that we get out of the lab are just amazing. We had a gentleman who's an Ironman triathlete, 73 years old, and
yeah.
He's blind.
Good. Wow.
He has competed in the Kona Ironman triathlon, but had some back issues, was treated for those back issues. He came to the lab because he wanted to get back to running, and he wanted to make sure that he could do another Ironman triathlon. That guy ran on the treadmill, blind. It's one of the scariest things I've done in my entire career.
Yeah.
That guy ran on the treadmill, and you had to learn to do things and give him feedback in different ways than I was, had been comfortable with. So we get everything, and each day is a new challenge, and every runner is unique. And it's one thing that I try to make sure that my students and the other people who are working in the lab remember that we can't cookie cutter anybody. We have to look at each individual as a unique case and try to give them the best treatment and the best recommendations for that person.
Yeah, and with some cool tools like that, got the 3D cameras, I mean, there can't be two people who are alike because there's so many variables. I'm sure you could even add more variables to your report and just make it detailed as you wanted to, but no two people are going to have the same fingerprint, even in running.
Yeah, that's a great, I love that term because we use that term a lot in the lab, is that each runner has their own fingerprint. Those mechanics that they present with is their running fingerprint. We can't recreate that in any one individual. So the idea of everyone should run with the same number of steps per minute, or everyone should strike the ground the same way, or everyone should be able to activate their glutes at a certain time during the stance phase. It's just not reasonable because all of the structural limitations and gender and age and 15 other variables that I could name are going to play into that puzzle.
That's cool to hear because a lot of times people will say if you use too much technology, then you are going towards like a cookie cutter mentality. But you get that kind of data, you can see there's so many different variables. And like you said, there's no right or wrong. I mean, even the Olympics just going on in Rio, somebody said, well, what's Michael Phelps' stroke count? How many times does he stroke before he breathes? And then we looked into it, and he just changes it. He breathes when he wants to, and he's the fastest guy on the planet. So that's good to hear that he's not even doing a cookie cutter for himself, being variable, being dynamic during a race.
Variability is not a bad thing. For a long time, we felt like in research that if we had too much variability in some particular variable that we were interested in, that was indicative of somebody that was pathological or uncoordinated. But there's been many studies shown since that time that lack of variability is potentially the injurious state rather than variability.
Especially in running because the terrain changes. You're going to go up, you're going to go down, you're going to be on different surfaces, you're going to be different pitches. If you can't adapt to that, you're not going to be very good. and you're probably going to get hurt.
Yep. And fatigue is a huge perturbing factor as well. So things are different at the beginning of a run than they are at mile six.
I'm usually dragging ass towards the end of the run. Come to think of it, I'm dragging ass in the beginning as well. But yeah, I mean, your goal as a runner, if you're going to do distances, be as efficient as possible. But if you don't have any variability, I can see exactly what you're saying is you're not going to be very efficient if you can't adapt to the course and where you are biochemically anyway. If you're dragging ass at the end of a race, if you can't be variable, probably going to be hurting.
Yeah, you got to pull in other resources.
What would you do if you had somebody who said, you know, I don't have any pain until like mile four? Would you bring them in a little early and get them on the treadmill early to get to mile four and five? Do you do something like that?
That's a good question. We do it sometimes. More often than that, what I do is, my personal philosophy is, they don't have any pain until mile four or five, but something is compounding up to the point where they get to that. Okay. So they can tolerate it, they can deal with it up to the fourth mile, but then it's just too much.
Right.
If you're looking at a mechanical profile, at that mechanical fingerprint, those mechanics probably are there even when they're not tired. Maybe they get worse when they're tired, or maybe they've just compounded on themselves along with some other variables that then it presents itself at mile four.
Gotcha.
So my first approach would be, let's see what the person looks like when they just run when they're 100%. And if I see things that don't look good at that point, I'm going to make just a logical assumption that things are not going to get any better when they get tired.
Right.
We'll address those things at that point and see if we can make an impact. If we go through that process and they're still not noticing some improvement based on what we recommend, then I might bring them back at a later time and say, all right, let's go get you up on the treadmill and just run for a half hour or so. Let me know when you have pain. I'll be over here sipping coffee. When you have pain, raise your hand and then we'll collect data on you. We've done that a few times, but I tend to think those things are there already.
So what you're saying, just to make sure I got it, is the reason they're having pain at mile four, for example, is probably something that happens between mile zero and mile four. So if you can spot it there, you can figure out the why.
Yeah, or something that's very little at mile zero or very little throughout the entire time, but it's just deviant enough with the increased number of steps and the 2.5 to 3 times body weight that we see that causes it to be problematic.
Gotcha. Are you able to calculate force data too with those cameras and the 3D stuff? That's got to be really cool.
Yeah, our treadmill, the Cadillac treadmill, has a force platform embedded in it.
Man, that's cool.
So that we can measure. A number of the measures that we use, kinematic measures, are predictive of those forces. So clinically, there's a lot of things that you can do even on your treadmill in the clinic without the big $100,000 treadmill that has a force platform. They can tell you things that are very, very similar.
Okay.
That's the work that I was referring to earlier from Brian Heiderscheidt and his group.
That's cool. That's really cool. That's a lot of data, and then you've still got to be able to synthesize it and apply it. I think sometimes we love to download these apps and we love to have toys, but if you're not able to actually say, all right, you were saying a lot of the things that you guys measure and put on your report is from the research, that's a great way to approach it. You're saying, okay, here's the things that we think are important to look at, and now we've established our norms, but we know people are going to be different, so let's put all these on a report and see where this person falls.
It has to be actionable. It has to be actionable. If it's not, it's great. I mean, these cameras and the force platforms and all the toys, accelerometers, all these things that we have, they're great. But if we can't do something with it and then make a change, impart some sort of reasonable, functional change in these individuals, it doesn't matter. You have the smartest people in the world, but if we can't make it clinically meaningful, it's useless. So these 3D motion analysis places like the VCU Run Lab, which I love and I go there every single day, and thank God that that's where I get to work. You don't have one in your clinic, and the guy down the street here doesn't have one in his clinic. So am I at some distinct advantage because I have that? Maybe, but I think it's my job as a researcher to take that information and to try to make it actionable so that everyone can use this, and not everyone doesn't have to come to the VCU Run Lab. They can go anywhere and get a very, very good running analysis done.
So you mentioned research, and just going to bring up some things that you're currently studying. Studies running in obese adolescents, landing in female college basketball players, ankle movement in individuals with diabetes, chronic ankle instability in runners, balance and coordination in surfers, injury mechanics and dancers, hip movement and strength and National Hockey League players, just to name a few. So you're not you work at the VCU Run Lab, but you're looking at a lot of different things, a lot of different populations, and the why. Why are these people having pain or not optimal performance? That's variability right there.
Yeah, what's really cool about that is we're able to learn a lot from those groups and apply them to other groups. One of the talks that I'm giving out here at the Team Concept Conference this weekend is on how to help running mechanics in athletes who are not runners. So we're talking about those female basketball players. Okay. We're talking about women's lacrosse players. We're talking about soccer players. They have to run as part of their sport. But I can tell you from our research and the other people out there, when you look at their basic running profile, I can tell who's a basketball player and who's a cross-country athlete just from looking at their biomechanical profile.
So just looking at their fingerprint, you can peg their sport.
They look different and they move different, and therefore the way that we intervene with them needs to be different. I was having this conversation with two of my PhD students the other day. Once we know this information about lacrosse players who move differently than basketball players who move differently than surfers and snowboarders, what do we do? Do we take the women's basketball player and start training her to make her look like a high school cross country runner? Is there some sort of gold standard that we're using where women are supposed to look like men, and then old people are supposed to look like young people, and basketball players are supposed to look like cross country runners? The answer is no. So we need to understand really the complexity of how these people move. And I think I have learned as part of my career, by looking at all of these various individuals, how they move within their sports, and how potentially we can cross those things over to help the cross-country runner move a little bit more efficiently because of what we know about the hockey player, and to help the dancer land a little bit more efficiently by what we know about ACL tears. These are things that we've looked at them in silos, in part because researchers tend to gravitate towards these areas, and for whatever reason. What we try to do, and what I've done throughout my career, is try to bring groups of people together and then understand, potentially, I can learn from a surfer how to treat someone who's had a stroke.
I mean, you bring up NHL hockey players. That jumps out at me. How are they at running?
I got to tell you that the hockey players of all the athletes I've ever worked with, other than really, really elite track and field athletes, are probably some of the most fit athletes.
Oh, yeah.
That are,
but how's it running?
They run fine, but they don't run very often.
Right.
They don't get hurt running. They tear their groin and shred their ankles, but they're running. They don't typically get hurt from their running. So cardiovascularly, they could run probably circles around both of us.
I bet, yeah. I mean, you've got to be a really well-conditioned athlete to be, anywhere near the NHL. So out of those populations of patients that I just mentioned that you're studying, what are some of the favorites that you have in terms of research?
So a lot of the stuff that you had mentioned is stuff that some of it's current and some of it I've done in the past. And the diabetic group, what we were most interested in was stiffness, ankle stiffness. So a lot of the work that I've done over the years has been either looking at vertical stiffness, treating the body as sort of a mass spring, or joint stiffness like torsional stiffness, bending stiffness. With diabetes, there's certainly changes in the collagen and the integrity of the collagen. Another adverse effect of diabetes is peripheral neuropathy, and then the loss of peripheral blood flow, development of ulcers, and then if those go unchecked and untreated properly, then amputation, and more amputation then decreases their lifespan. So certainly stopping someone from getting an ulcer and losing a toe is something that we want to do. So we were interested in how much the actual loss of collagen and how they walked maybe impacted the pressures that they were getting underneath the bottom of their foot. We were interested in ankle stiffness and how much how stiff the ankle was late in the stance phase when they actually went to push off, which is when the big toe was in contact with the ground. And we found some distinct changes in that ankle stiffness and how they moved. And so it has implications for either joint mobilizations, trying to change that tissue stiffness, getting them to walk differently, footwear, a number of different implications, knowing that there is, in fact, it's not just pressure underneath the foot, but changes in the ankle, in the how the ankle is functioning late in stance phase. That was a very interesting group to understand.
Yeah, I bet. So it shows the vastness or the different ways that you can actually look at, you know, running or walking biomechanics in a population that isn't just runners. It's called a VCU Run Lab, and you specialize in runners, but everybody moves. So you're just kind of using the same tools, and as a PT, you can be versatile like that to study something vastly different like balance in surfers and NHL players and diabetic individuals with ankle problems.
Yeah, you want to keep people moving. I think as physical therapists, you know, something that's come out in our field, and we've known it for a long time, but it's really been pushed to the forefront, is that we are the movement specialists. I go further than that, and I say that we need to understand how everyone moves, because human movement is really the fifth vital sign. If you stop moving, you die. We need to be able to keep people active, keep people moving. So a kid who's obese doesn't move the same way as a kid who's not obese and doesn't move as much.
Right.
Their lifespan, just because of the fact that they're not moving, is reduced.
Wow.
That diabetic patient who can't feel their feet and is losing balance, they're going to stop moving, or they're going to move less. They're going to die sooner. And those are huge reasons for physical therapists to really be involved in understanding in the total care of any patient, whether it's a runner or whether it's a 68-year-old obese person with diabetes.
Man, if that isn't a great pitch for physical therapy, I'm not really sure what is. That's awesome. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about more sports section of the APTA. Since you're the VP, we got to give a plug for that. A little bit about X-Phys and the work with the Exercise Physiology Research Lab and Cool Without the C. We're going to talk about that website that you're involved with after the break. Don't move. What if we summarized every episode we released and gave you links to all of the websites, articles, people, and things that we talked about during each show? Oh, we do that already. Get Episode Chasers for all of our shows available now at ptpintcast.com. Introducing EcoPro Pillow Covers, good for the environment and your clinic's bottom line. EcoPro Pillow Covers are the clinic pillowcase replacement designed to be wiped clean just like your treatment tables. Each EcoPro Pillow Cover saves you 2,600 gallons of water per year, time spent laundering pillowcases, and the money involved with clinic laundry, with no special cleaner required. A special deal for Pintcast listeners: when you order online at EcoProPillows.com, you'll get free shipping on any size order with the promo code Pintcast. EcoPro Pillow Covers, created by PTs for PTs. Considering a travel assignment over the holidays, or ready to escape the cold weather for some winter sunshine? Arias Medical Group is the leading healthcare staffing agency, offering travel and full-time career opportunities for PTs nationwide. Call Arias at 1-800-340-2619 or visit ariusmedical.com. That's A-U-R-E-U-S medical.com.
Let's give a nice, warm Winterfest welcome to...
We're back. It's so great to see you. Let's get back to the show now. We're back on the PT Pintcast with Blaze Williams from Virginia Commonwealth University and the VCU Run Lab. Blaze, three questions we ask on every show from our sponsors, Arias Medical Staffing. Question number one, where in the U.S., we're in the 50 U.S. states that you haven't lived, have you always thought about going to be a PT? What's like a cool destination you wouldn't mind living?
Durango, Colorado.
Oh, yeah. Why? What draws you up there?
I did work in Shiprock, New Mexico, which is down in the Four Corners region. But okay. Durango, it's on the western slope of the Rockies. It's one of the most beautiful places in the world, and there's a huge need for PT out in that area. And then when you're done with your day of work, you can head out onto the mountain bike trails or go snowshoeing or snowboarding or skiing or drink some of the most awesome craft beer in the world right there.
I'm sold. I'll go there with you. Let's do that. Question number two. What is something that you have recently read or are reading that really, really got you fired up? It can be PT or non-PT related.
I got to think of the name of the book now. I read the book, but it's called The Power of Why, or The Question
Start of, With Why?
Start With Why. That's
Simon Sinek?
Yeah, Cool. Start with why. It just made me think more about how we go through our day, and rather than just doing things, we're actually asking questions about the reasons behind them rather than just doing them, but actually figuring out the reasons why. Yeah.
Yeah. And nobody can see this because it's a podcast, but I just pulled the book out of my backpack. I just got sent this book by actually our executive producer, Rachel German, and she says she read the book in like a day and was just like, you need to read this book.
It goes really fast, and I don't know that it changes your perspective, but I think it just enhances some things that you naturally know that you should do or think about things that way. But as human nature and just life kind of gets in the way, and we just do rather than asking why we're doing these things. And I think if you ask why you do things, as we do in research, don't just assume something, but ask questions about why we're doing it. It enhances how much better it could be.
Coming from a background of radio, I can't believe I bring up so many situations from my radio career on a PT podcast, but like they're very similar in that I'd be in a boardroom, we'd be talking about how we were going to put together a presentation for a client, how we're going to put together a campaign, and you'd be shocked. People would just be ready to do the same thing we've always done, and you ask that little question, why, and the room goes dead silent. And if the answer is because we've always done it, that's the wrong answer. That's the wrong answer.
We've always done it just as bad a reason, particularly in research, is, well, no one's done it yet. Well, that's not a good enough reason. There has to be more of a justification for why we want to move forward with things.
That's a cool book. Yeah, looking forward to getting that one. Third question on three questions. Who's somebody else in the PT field that we should know more about? Maybe someone who's flying under the radar but doing great things.
Well, maybe people know about this person more than I think they do, but there's a guy named John DeWitt. Who's okay. at the Ohio State University.
Yeah, I've heard of him, yeah.
And John is a young guy. He's got a ton of energy and is extremely smart and is really driving one of the most important portions of our PT profession right now, which is our residencies. If you're familiar with Ohio State University and their PT division and their PT program, they have several residencies there. And these residencies, and he's really responsible for driving those forward and really driving residencies across the country. He probably is doing more for our profession by really pushing and helping our residencies grow than maybe anyone else within our profession.
That's cool. All right, you're off the hot seat. That's three questions right there.
That's easy.
All right, so cool without the C. I'm going to say it wrong. Ool Running, but it can't be that. There's a website you're involved with. How is it pronounced?
All Run.
Okay, but it's spelled OOL Run.
It is, and it's a Mayan word that means spirit or soul, and it really sort of gets at why we all run. We get out there to run because it makes us feel good. There's no right, and there's no wrong, and the motivation behind that, it's really more of a public service that we did it. The person who's my partner with that website is a runner, and he's a retired Wall Street guy, and he's a sub-3-hour marathoner. He's a really talented runner, but came to running a little bit later in life and just had so much passion for running and so much motivation, intelligence, that we got together and try to launch, or basically launch this website. Provide information that we feel is accurate for the general running public. Provide some motivational daily items, tidbits for people to be a resource for the general running community. We really have a lot of followers on there, and we get a lot of questions offline that we then turn into some of the articles that we do. And it's just been a great experience.
That's cool. People could check it out. I didn't say it all running, but it's OOLRUN.com. And I found out something I didn't know. Why is the marathon 26.2 miles? And I found this out during the first Olympic Games. The marathon was roughly 40 kilometers. But, of course, the Queen... So they added the extra 385 yards inside the stadium to have the finish line be right in front of the royal family's viewing box. So where the Queen was sitting. I'll tell you, anybody who's run a marathon, 26 miles is hard, but that .2 is really just a kick in the gut at the end.
Yeah.
You do some work with the Exercise Physiology Research Laboratory, Department of Kinesiology and Health Sciences. And so you have... you know, biomechanical, and then you have biochemical. And is that kind of what you're looking at there? Is that what they're looking at in exercise physiology research lab? Is more of the chemical and where it meets the biomechanical?
Yeah, so a lot of the questions that have been asked when it comes to running efficiency and running injury on the biomechanics side has traditionally been separated from what's happening on the phys side. About 10 years ago, I had the opportunity to start working with a group down at Furman University, the Furman Institute of Running and Scientific Training. They're all physiologists down there, really good physiologists, and have developed that 3+2 program, if you're familiar with that, 3 days of running, 2 days of cross training, 2 days off. So it's the run less, run faster sort of model. And it's all physiology based, and it's all sort of efficiency based. But great exercise physiologist. They brought me in as a biomechanist, and that's when I started to realize that probably this overlap between efficiency and biomechanics and physiology. But I didn't have that relationship, and there weren't people really doing that kind of research when I was at East Carolina University. When I left East Carolina University and came to Virginia Commonwealth University, they did have an exercise physiology lab who was where the scientists there, particularly Lee Franco, was very interested in that kind of work. So it was kind of a natural fit for us to kind of bring together those two things, and we've utilized that primarily in testing our intercollegiate athletes. So we do a lot of preseason testing for our intercollegiate athletes, women's basketball, men's basketball, women's soccer, women's lacrosse, cross country. And they'll come in, and they'll get biomechanics. They'll get tested on their biomechanics side. They'll get tested on the phys side. And then Dr. Franco and I will go together to meet with the coaches and the strength and conditioning coaches and the athletic trainers and talk to them about what our findings are. And that helps them make decisions about how they're going to train those individuals throughout the season. We do it for other individuals as well. And we've done a couple of research studies on that side, where we looked at half marathon trainers, but for the most part, it's been our intercollegiate athletes that we utilize that with.
That's cool. That sounds fun. It's looking at the whole picture, like you said. Everybody's got a fingerprint of running, but also the rest of their systems come into play as well.
It's a lot of fun, and I've learned a lot from those guys. So again, it's for me, it's been a place where I can get more information about those runners and potentially how we can help them better.
That's cool. So I'd be a bad podcast host if I didn't let you plug a little bit. Current vice president of the sports physical therapy section of the APTA. I'm a member. So give a reason why someone should become a member of not only a section, but of the sports section. I mean, I've been to a couple of events. They're real fun. But, you're the VP, so, you've got the mic. Talk to everybody. Why should they join?
The sections, a lot of times people don't understand what the sections are within the APTA. And the sections are really the engine that drives the programming and the educational aspects of what it is we do as physical therapists. The APTA is our governing body. They look out for us, and they make sure that we're following all the laws, and they make laws, and they lobby for us, and they do all those things to keep us strong as a profession. But the sections handle the content. We're the people that drive what it is we do and makes us experts within the world of physical therapy. Being a sports physical therapist in today's day and age is becoming more and more important because athletic trainers, our interaction with athletic trainers and our access to athletic trainers and sports physicians and orthopedic surgeons has become much easier. But it's also become more important where all of those groups understand what the strengths of each one of those professions is. Allows us to shine in what it is that we do, and that is understanding human movement and understanding rehabilitation and returning to human movement or sport-specific movement. And that's really what this Team Concepts Conference is about. It's about focusing on how do we interact with that orthopedic surgeon? What is our role? How can the orthopedic surgeon understand what it is we do so that they know they can trust, our professionalism when it comes to those things. So
and that's big. That's big.
Yeah, it's huge. And so the sports section is really the advocate for that. We go to and as the vice president, my role really is to go to the membership to get information from the membership about what it is that they feel like we as a sports section can offer them, what kind of educational opportunities are out there. how well are we doing at offering residencies? How are those residencies interacting with the PT programs? How well are we doing at training our students? All of those things, it kind of falls on the shoulders of the vice president. So it's been a great experience. It's a lot of work. It's I get to talk to a lot of people, and it's easy for me to get out there and rah-rah the sports section, because I think the sports section is great, and they're doing great things, and we're growing as a section. We're the largest growing section, and if you ever go to CSM every year, a lot of the programming comes from our section. The sessions that our section provides, people are out the door. Sometimes you can't even get in them because they're so well attended.
That's cool. And my roommates who are all PTs or SPTs also dig the fact that I get JOSPT when it comes out. So I just leave that on the coffee table and just leave it there.
So, I mean, that's been kind of the selling point over the years is, hey, you get the journal, and that's fine. I mean, I think that is a good selling point. But I think there's so much more to it than just the journal. And it used to be when people said, well, why should I join a section? And you're like, well, you get you get JOSPT, and people are like, you know, okay, that's pretty good, but is it worth my $60 a year or my $80 a year to get this journal? As a scientist, I would say, yeah, it is worth it, but there's so many other things that the section is doing to grow us as a profession now.
Plus you've got, within the section, you've got special interest groups, you've got emergency response, female, golf, hip, knee, shoulder, running, residency, fellowships, tactical athlete, which is a new one that just came on board. So there's sections within the interest groups within the section as well, to get specific.
Right, and the interest groups are great because there's a lot of students involved in the interest groups, and the interest groups actually drive the programming. So the interest groups submit every year the things that they're interested in presented at CSM and at TCC. So it's kind of a bottom up. We're allowing those SIGs, rightly so, as the expert groups, to push the programming to teach us as a section and help us grow.
That's real
so
cool.
Join the APTA, join the sports section, and then join a SIG.
Yeah. This is The Parting Shot.
Powered by Optum, Optum offers weekend courses that are Monday morning applicable, utilizing approaches that make sense.
They promote excellence in hands-on treatment, exercise prescription, pain science, and clinical reasoning, offering a COMT,
as well as an APTA-accredited fellowship in orthopedic manual therapy, both online and in-person mentoring, with locations in Houston, Dallas, and Scottsdale, Arizona. Find out more online
at optumfellowship.com.
And before we're done, we do shots. Parting shots of wisdom. If you were to leave everybody out there with one parting shot of wisdom to go forth into their career.
You have to look at that patient who's standing in front of you as an individual. And there are no cookie cutters. There's no easy way. And it's hard as a new grad. It's hard as a student to problem solve. Your tendency is to move towards, I've seen this before, and this is what I want
to do. We hope to as a student.
Yeah. What you want to do, what you want to be able to do is to make sure that you see the problem before it sees you, and not realizing something that's going on can really put you back at the very least a few weeks and maybe a few months with the treatment of that patient. So
I like that.
Ask all those questions and don't rush through your evals. Make sure you get all that information, because each patient's going to present differently.
I like that. I think you can apply that to any type of PT, not just sports, to see that problem before it sees you. I like that a lot. Blaze Williams, VCU Run Lab, Virginia Commonwealth University. You can follow him on Twitter at RunDocBlaze. That's RUNDOCBLAISE. Appreciate you taking the time out to talk with us. It's been a cool interview.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Get every episode we release delivered fresh right to you. Subscribe to the PT Pinecast on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher Radio. And never miss an ice cold episode.
The PT Pinecast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that.